Happy Friday, Murdoch Murders podcast superfans, and welcome to our second Cup of Justice bonus episode, serving you hot legal takes to get your weekend started on the right foot. A couple things before we start. On Wednesday's episode of the Murdoch Murders podcast, episode 62, we told you about what went down at Russell Lafitte's shocking bond modification hearing in federal court. Highly suggest y'all go back to that episode before listening to this one so it makes the most sense. But for a quick recap, Russell and his wife Susie asked the court to remove the federal ankle monitor because it was interfering with their lifestyle. The judge didn't reverse her decision, but did take Russell off of house arrest. After reading the transcript from the hearing, Liz Farrell, Eric Blanda, and I got together and had a good time analyzing everything that went down at that hearing. There was so much ground to cover. And shout out to the Westin Hilton Head Island Resort and Spa, one of my favorite spots on Hilton Head, for hooking us up with a gorgeous setting to record this episode in. Y'all are awesome, and we really appreciate the hospitality. So there is a lot happening with this case right now because Russell is sort of set to go to trial in November on the 6 federal charges he's facing, which includes conspiracy to commit wire and bank fraud, 2 counts of bank fraud, 1 count of wire fraud, and 2 counts of misapplication of bank funds. On Wednesday afternoon, a federal grand jury issued a second superseding indictment against Russell that basically corrected some errors in the previous indictments and added more information about the crimes he is accused of committing, which we will cover in a later episode. But today, we're going to talk about the shocking decision from Russell's defense team to put him on the stand and how the justice system can be different for a privileged person like Russell Lafitte. So to start off, let's talk about the players, beginning with Assistant U.S. Attorney Emily Limehouse, the lead prosecutor on the case.
This will tell you how good a lawyer Emily Limehouse is. She did not know that Russell was going to testify.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, when I have a trial, the judge will say, okay, who's going to put up what witness tomorrow? And you'll say, well, I'm putting up Jerry. Well, I'll go home and I'll pull out all the exhibits and I'll prepare my cross-examination of Jerry. She was going in for a bond modification hearing, Emily. She didn't even know that Mrs. Lafitte was going to be reading a statement. So,
well, she lucked out.
On the fly, when Bart was giving the direct examination to Russell, she's preparing a cross-examination. And I got to tell you, that girl did really good.
Yeah, so Mandy, your opinion of Emily Limehouse after reading that, what do you think?
Well, I thought Bart Daniel and team underestimated her.
Yes.
I think that they thought that they could put Russell on the stand and get there. Well, feel sorry for us. And I think they assumed that she would throw softball questions at him.
Right.
And man, she rapid fired, drilled it home.
If the goal was for him to get empathy from the judge or from those that listen to it, I think it failed.
Well, because as you pointed out, it's like a phrasing of some of the things that she said to him. It's like intentional phrasing that she said. So the minor, at any time she was referring to the victims, she made sure to make that the courtroom or the record knows that these are not just, these are minor children, like you took from children, just to reiterate. And then she would, with the income tax, she would make these little sort of things and get him to say the thing that is the most basically the obvious to the rest of us, and kind of stunning that he would admit some of that.
No, like she said, well, you didn't pay this back. And he said, yes, I did.
Yeah.
And she said, no, you lied about that. And he said, no, I didn't. I'm telling the truth. And then she'd show him and he said, well, I guess I was wrong. Well, really, if you're under oath and you're going to tell the truth. Don't have to be proven wrong. And then when you're proven wrong, you just get to say, I was just a little incorrect.
Right. Yeah. So who among us laughed when Russell got that second ankle monitor? We can be honest.
We all laughed.
I laughed.
I thought it was so funny. It seemed a little unbelievable, but I guess the idea that...
The only people that were shocked in the courtroom was the Murdaugh side, our side, when we got up and we argued.
Did you just call them the Murdaugh side?
Yeah, because that's what... I think they're that's what they are. And, you know,
they call
themselves victims. Listen, they're all trying to separate themselves from Alex, but they were tied to the hip with him for 40 years when it was convenient. So now when it's not inconvenient, when it's inconvenient, you can't separate. But the fact of the matter is, it was a joke to think that this man should get a $20,000 bond with no restrictions on federal charges when the sentence is that if he's convicted are over 10 years. These are serious crimes. And like I said, it's not a parking ticket.
Right. So now, September 6th, back in the federal court.
But you saw what was going to happen. Because
where you mean?
In the original bond hearing, Bart, or it was Matt Austin, got up and said, we don't disagree with much of what has been said. What we're saying is what he did wasn't criminal. So that was a forecast of what we heard on September 6th, because when Russ testified, he basically admitted to everything. And then if you go to the transcript on page 112, Bart gave you his conclusion. Bart Daniels said he breached his fiduciary duties, he was negligent and possibly grossly negligent, but he's not criminal.
So I just have to say that taking this case to trial is a big gamble for Russell, because he faces dozens of years in federal prison. And having Russell take the stand just a couple months before he's set to go to trial, that is a huge gamble, especially all just for a pesky ankle monitor.
No, and a judge usually doesn't reverse their decision. That's a big thing for a judge.
Yeah.
When a judge makes a ruling, judges don't like to change their order, because if they change their order, then they start to look like they're vacillating or they weren't really sure or wasn't a good order the first time.
And there really wasn't a good... Did you read the motion and the memos in support and against?
Right. There really wasn't cogent reasons why there should be a change or why Judge Cherry was wrong the first time.
Right.
Yeah.
That was so...
I read it as like kind of a whining that's what it seemed like.
This has been the whole thing in this Murdaugh case. All these defense lawyers are kicked back on their heels. You can't parlay on your back foot. Right. And they're all shocked. Dick and Jim were shocked when Alex's bond was $7 million.
Boy, were they ever.
First, he didn't get bond
by
Judge Newman. And then Judge Lee, who they thought is going to be more amenable to a lower bond, she comes in at $7 million, not even a 10%, just raised $7 million.
I have to ask, Mandy, is that one of the most particular points of pride, is when you see the good old boys, like the look on their face when they realize they haven't gotten their way?
Right.
I will never forget the first bond hearing, it was technically Alex's second bond hearing in Columbia, when Newman denied his bond and Harpootlian. I was right behind him, and he stood up and just freaked out.
That was our arguments, because I got up and I told Judge Newman, there's 300 cameras here in this courtroom and the whole world's watching. Our justice system is on trial. Our states have a black eye. And Ronnie said, well, I don't think, I think the bond should be commensurate with how much he stole. I think it should be $8 million. And the whole courtroom, all the lawyers, like, nobody's ever asked for $8 million before.
Yeah, it turned into the Muppet Show for a minute there with a lot of people murmuring.
Yeah.
Because you remember Dick got up after he said no bond. He's like, I immediately wanted you to reconsider this. What do we do? Let's get the psychiatrist to say that he's clear of drugs. Because Newman was really sharp. He said, I'm not sure he's over this drug dependency that he's got. It's drug addiction. Mm-hmm. That was one of the major things. And Dick was saying, well, we're going to go get an expert who's going to say he's had the treatment, he's good, he's no longer an addict.
So going back to what Mandy said, so the original motion to reconsider a modified bond read to you like whining, because it was basically like, we don't like this, change it.
Yeah, and it didn't really say why he deserves his bond to be changed. It was just,
because
I
want
to go to my kids' football.
I'm not a normal criminal.
So,
but
going into it.
But the feds were completely caught off guard because...
Well, don't say it yet. So we go into this hearing, right? None of us are there.
Right.
But there is high drama going into it because of the motions, because of the memos. It got a little ugly, right? We can say that.
Oh, between
the federal government. And so we all assumed Russell would be getting this like sweet plea deal. And then that would be the end of talking about federal court.
Yeah, Bart's definitely been operating under a high state of agitation. And he's not a lawyer that does that. He's not a high drama lawyer. He's not a lawyer that shows emotion. He's a lawyer that's very measured.
Right.
But you could tell, even after our original bond hearing, when we were outside on Broad Street, and we were talking to one of the reporters, and he walked by with his mirror shades on, and he cut me a glance like, you knew he's upset. And he's been saying all along, this has been fueled by the plaintiff lawyers. Like somehow we caused his client to steal money or loan money or do whatever he's charged with.
No, you're just messing up his game. So let's talk a little bit about the players, right? So Bart Daniel is another one of the Titans in South Carolina.
He is.
He was a U.S. You want to give like a little bit of his history and like what you know about him?
An assistant U.S. attorney. He's a hardcore Republican. You know, he's obviously Lindsey Graham's attorney in the grand jury investigation that's going on in Atlanta over the election stuff. So he's a serious contender. He was considered for the impeachment. He was going to be one of Trump's attorneys for the impeachment. He was under consideration.
It seems like a lot of South Carolina attorneys. We have Debbie Barbier.
We're involved with that.
Yeah. And Butch Bowers. Butch Bowers. All involved with the Murdoch case also.
So in the 80s, he was an assistant U.S. attorney. Mm-hmm. And when we had the scandal with the legislature.
That was the drug
operation Lost Trust.
Lost Trust.
But wasn't he in Jackpot? Wasn't he?
He was that too. Yeah, he was that. And he cut his teeth on that. And then he further solidified his reputation where he took down all these legislators who jeopardized their career and their reputations for $100 bribes, $200 bribes.
Times are tough, Eric. So with Bart, why would you hire Bart? Now, who hires Bart these days?
He doesn't really do the blue collar murder crime like Jack Swerling does or Dick does.
Did you say blue collar murder crime? What's that?
Yeah, it's the people that would do drug crimes or you go in and you rob a store. Yeah, he's the white collar criminal. The company that commits tax fraud or, you know, the person who's insider trading and gets charged. You know, the kind of crimes where you don't get your hands dirty, where you come home at night and your suitcases are full of cash. That's the kind of people he represents.
Okay. So it's basically federal cases.
Rich
though,
people,
right?
It sounds like.
Very rich.
He's got people who have rich man problems.
Right. So these are guys that when they get their target letter from the FBI or the Department of Justice or however it works, they're probably going to call a Bart Daniel.
And why are they going to do that? You tell me.
Because he used to be a U.S. attorney.
Let's just get to the point with what Eric's
trying to say. That whole thing of switching sides is really interesting to me. And I find it interesting because when I sue lawyers, it's like the client and the lawyer, they merge. And the lawyer who was representing my client, who I'm suing now for legal malpractice, he loved my client's case when he wanted to bring it. Until he screwed it up. Now he's on the other side of the courtroom and all of a sudden, that case was worthless.
Right.
And I say, well, worthless? You were willing to take it on a contingency. You were willing to give all your time. Now all of a sudden it's worthless. I find the same thing with prosecutors. I mean, they're zealous and they're doing the job of the law and they're putting bad guys away. They're putting bad guys away. And then all of a sudden they announce their retirement. And they walk to the other side of the street. Now they're representing the bad guy.
Right, because now they need to get that money. It's probably hard to watch.
It kind of fits into the stereotype that lawyers don't really have loyalties. You know, that they, if you pay me, I'll say. You pay, I'll say. Right. That's really what it looks like. I mean, I'm going to be honest.
So as far as conviction, you know, I guess we're not even looking for that here. But so Bart Daniel is who Russell Lafitte hired.
It's a good hire.
Fairly early on in all of this. So going into, so now we know who Bart is and we know who Matt. So Matt is at the table too with Russell and Bart.
Right.
So now we're on September 6th, Tuesday, September 6th, dramatic day. And again, I think it bears repeating that when the feds come for you and they indict you.
They come.
It's they as come good heavy. As you did it basically, right? Like they have the goods.
Yeah, is what Junior saying. Junior Soprano said to Tony, "The next time you come, come heavy." They come heavy.
Okay, so when we're at this point, there's some conclusions you can sort of draw, which is that they think they have the goods.
Yeah, if you look at the conviction rate on a federal court, it's almost like 99%. And what they do is they put you in a situation that you almost have to plead, because in state court, Alex is an unusual case where they bring so many charges.
Right.
In state court, there's usually one or two charges. Federal court, they bring like 22 charges. Right. And if you get convicted on one of those counts, it's like 8 years. And we will be right back.
So now also talk about Susie. So having Susie Lafitte speak after Russell is on the stand for 2.5 hours, now you have her doing a 15-page, you know, speech to the courtroom, to the ladies and gentlemen of the courtroom. What
Judge Gergel, Judge Gergel's going to have read that transcript.
Right. And Judge Gergel's who's probably going to preside over this, or do we know he is presiding over this?
He is presiding. Okay. And Judge Gergel is a tremendous judge. He's a fair judge. But
yeah, great reputation.
But he's human.
Sure.
Judges are human, and things soak into you. And Richard Gergel is not a judge that likes people who are privileged and try to separate themselves from the rank and file.
Now, why would he read that transcript? Like, what is a judge? Is that how they prepare for the case, or they just have
They're going to look at the record. It's part of the record.
Okay.
And they're going to read everything, and he's going to want to learn. If he's presiding over the trial, he's going to want to learn, and he's going to have law clerks that are going to consume that entire file.
Okay.
And judges are human. What Richard Gergel doesn't like is two systems of justice. And what I'm starting to feel like in this Lafitte case is that Big Russ needs to be treated differently than everybody else. And his wife got up and almost was talking down to all of us. Can't you see the greatness in my husband? Is this how you should treat greatness?
Right. Yes. Is this how you should treat greatness? That's exactly
it. He doesn't deserve And
but I think in reading the transcript, you know, obviously different things strike different people differently. For Mandy and me, though, a lot of our conversations in the past few days have been centered around that ecosystem in Hampton County and sort of like you're in high school or not, like your world, when you're in high school, your world is so small and contained to high school, right? So problems that now that you're an adult that you had in high school are very small. And, you know, but when you're in high school, you think, oh my God, that's just the biggest thing ever. So
right.
I think there's sort of an insularity here where Susie and Russell have their world. It's tiny.
It's not the real world, huh? It's
no.
World.
Yeah,
it?
It's very, it's, she used the word disturbing when describing missing football games, missing his son's football games.
Missing.
That was my biggest takeaway. She did not realize like the seriousness and the totality of the crimes that her husband is accused of being involved in.
Talk about the tone a little, like when you're reading it, what you thought about how she sounded and maybe like how did she start it? How?
She started it with something like, ladies and gentlemen of the courtroom, which I thought was very strange. And the whole thing was to get sympathy, but it
came across as arrogant.
Extremely arrogant and out of touch.
No question.
Because this entire thing is what we're dealing with is people who were very vulnerable in way worse positions than the Lafittes are in right now.
People who are so vulnerable that, you know, people that lost a mother,
right?
People that lost a brother, they're in a fog, you know?
Yeah.
How am I going to get on with my life? Can you imagine the Plyler girls? It's not that these are financial crimes. The financial crimes happened as a result of tragedy.
Yeah, of like high trauma.
High trauma.
Yeah.
I was surprised that his wife, Susie, spoke.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the details that stuck out to me. I think it went on for 3 hours.
Yeah.
Which that was surprising.
It was like, what is happening here?
What is going on? Because, again, these are usually in and out very quick. And then to find out that Russ testified
yeah.
for as long as he did, not right. just –
Now, for him to even open his mouth is stunning.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that in a second. So, and then the big thing for two major things for me, it was the double wide trailer that his wife said. And then there was the tax. He had not reported some of the fees that he had received for these conservatorship/personal.
Oh, yes, he did. He reported them. No. He did. It's all good.
Yeah. You sound like him now. He had not reported them.
He had not.
Prior to a certain point in time in 2021.
By the way, these taxable years were 2012, 13, and 14.
Right, okay.
He just happened to forget income that was three times more than what your W-2 income was.
Right. So we knew from the stories that obviously this was a lot more than we had bargained. And the end result was that he just had his house arrest lifted. So he's allowed to travel now in Allendale and Hampton County. That was not what the defense wanted, obviously. But now, Eric, you ordered the transcript, as you would often do, I guess, in a situation like this, because it pertains to your case.
Yeah, because it pertained to my case. I probably wouldn't have, Liz, until I heard that he was testifying, because when a defendant opens his mouth, it's called an admission by a party opponent. So if I'm being charged of a crime or I'm a defendant in a case, the only person I can talk to in a privileged capacity is my lawyer, my priest, and in certain situations, my wife. Not my children, certainly not my friends, certainly not the media. And so when a defendant opens his mouth under oath, that is testimony that can be used against him to impeach him. And we'll be right back.
So we've got the scene set, we got the tone, we got all of that. Now, talk about what people were saying about Bart. Are you allowed to talk about what people are saying about Bart Daniel for putting him up on the stand?
Let me not put it in a term. You can talk about Bart. I'll just put it in. If a lawyer puts his client on the stand and in direct examination has his client testify as to all of the criminal charges and why did you do what you did, is unheard of. It's never done, because you don't have to prove anything as a defendant. Right. It's the government's burden of proof. And they just gave a roadmap to the prosecution on what their defense is.
Right, which is what now?
Now their defense is, I'm a victim. Bart Daniel said he breached his fiduciary duties. He was grossly negligent and possibly grossly negligent, but not criminal.
So how many times have you seen this happen before where the defense puts their guy on the stand during a bond reconsideration hearing?
I'm telling you, it's less than probably, there's been a statistic, the ABA did it one time that said 4%. I think it's even less. Probably 2% of the time that a defendant will actually get on the stand and testify in their own defense. They do it if it's a self-defense type of case or stand your ground, something where you admit, I did shoot somebody, right, or I did do it, but here's why.
Which I guess they kind of are. They're saying he did do these things. He just doesn't think they're crimes. Russell Lafitte world.
No, but what he did, though, is Bart Daniel walked him directly into civil judgments with what he did, with what he said and what he had him testify to. Remember, this is a bond hearing, Liz and Mandy. This wasn't a trial.
Yes.
And so all he was trying to do was show, I'm not a danger to the community and a flight risk. Now, if his trial was 5 years from now, maybe you can justify the loosening of the restraints and put him up. But you didn't have to put him up to show that he wasn't a flight risk or a danger to the community. His wife could have done it. His children could have done it. But to put him up, you waive your privilege against self-incrimination. You waive the attorney-client privilege because he said that Alex was his attorney, and now he gets into his discussions with Alex. So when you decide you're going to put your client up in a criminal case, it's a risk-benefit analysis. Right. Is the juice worth the squeeze? His trial is in November 8th.
Right.
So to take this kind of risk and waive all these privileges and give a roadmap to the prosecution, to the federal government, of what your case, your defense is, for 6 weeks of being able to travel in Allendale and Hampton, somebody made a bad decision.
So, yeah, in summary, so like when we're talking about like the reason we're there, we're literally there so that he can have one of his ankle monitors taken off so that he can go to football games for the 6 week duration between now, or maybe the 2 month duration, we can say, between September 6th and November 8th.
He needs to sell concessions, you know, don't forget too.
Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah. Football was brought up like 17 times in the
Yeah, that really seemed to be like the drama.
Small town. I mean,
exactly. Which reminds me of high
Friday
school.
Night lights.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And again, I just don't think that his attorneys are understanding what normal people go through. And the entire time I was reading all of Russell's struggles with his ankle monitors, I was just thinking in my head, well, that's a lot better than jail.
That's, I get it that he's under house arrest. That's an inconvenience. That's not sitting in jail. It's not the same thing. Well, he was under house arrest. There's people who are sitting in jail. He gets to go out and cook on his grill and eat filet mignon if somebody's going to go to the store and pick up the steak for him.
Right.
And it's not the same, Liz.
Alleged double wide, yeah.
Right.
So now we're talking about going to trial. So the trial right now is set for November 8th. I personally don't think we're going to see a trial. I think all of this is a lead up to. It seems like a kind of a game of chicken in that the defense is daring the prosecution to bring their case to trial, and the prosecution is taking them up on their bluff, or maybe, you know, I'm not sure who's bluffing. Maybe no one, maybe both.
Well, you know, there was an attorney in the upstate that was, I gave an interview and he was the counterpoint to me, and he said, well, you know, the defense wants to go to trial as quick as possible because they don't want the prosecution to be adequately prepared. And then he said, well, the prosecution wants to go as fast as they can to trial because they don't want defense to be prepared. Well, at that point, if everybody's going to trial so fast, then no one's going to be prepared.
Right.
That's not justice.
No.
You know, yes, we want speedy trial. There is the speedy trial rule, and people shouldn't languish with charges over their head because we're innocent to be proven guilty. But when you rush justice, you don't get full cup.
Right.
We cannot rush justice. It's something that has to happen organically because different things happen along the way. Different things are going to be revealed. What if somebody starts to cooperate? What if you try Russ too quickly and Alex decides he would have cooperated, or Corey Fleming would have decided, I'm going to cooperate? So all these cases are intertwined. And if we're rushing them, we're losing the opportunity where people can cooperate, and it would change the dynamic of the case.
And what they don't understand is Russell Lafitte having two ankle monitors that tangle him up at night, or whatever she said.
Yeah.
She's I'm sorry, it's funny. Cause
it is funny.
Tough to take a bath.
You
plug them in, you're wet. You know, yeah. God forbid you're getting shocked.
Well, you know, I Googled that, and you actually can take a shower with them on. Because I was like, I want to know what it's like for
not
Russell
plug
to
in,
be.
Though,
certainly can't plug him in. But Russell's a giant man. He's a 6'6 or 6'7,
yeah,
something like
drink.
That. So, you know, the idea that he has to charge himself a couple hours a day, according to his testimony, you know, there's a certain amount of pleasure, I guess, that the world can take in that. But yeah, going back to the tone, these are people who maybe aren't used to consequence or account, you know, being having to have any sort of inconvenience.
I don't.
What
think-
about the guy that's sitting in jail that can't make his bond? I'm not talking about Alex, but the normal people that aren't getting their cases to trial
right.
in November 8th. They get their. This guy was charged in May or July federally. And now he's getting a trial in November.
Right.
Alex is charged with murder in June. He's getting his trial potentially in January. What about these people who are sitting in jail who've committed...
They can't afford justice, Eric. They can't afford it. They need a coupon, some sort of voucher.
No, that's not justice that they can't afford. They can't afford
to be... These guys are paying for this justice right now.
Yeah, and that's not kind of the definition of what justice should be. Deuteronomy said... Sirdik, Sadik, which is a Hebrew for justice, shall thou pursue. These prosecutors aren't pursuing justice for all these other people sitting in jail. They're pursuing it against the people that they want to pursue it against. Yeah.
The Murdoch Murders podcast is created by me, Mandy Matney, and my fiancé, David Moses. Our executive editor is Liz Farrell.
Produced by Luna Shark Productions.